We're gonna do a combination of the antimicrobial that we missed last week and the diagnostic immunologic principles. So I cut out some of the slides. You still need to go through the PowerPoint slides that we're not going to talk about. But I'm just going to cover the most important points so that we can get through both of these today. Tomorrow's test will not include what we talk about today. I think there will be a couple questions that are on there because I already had it printed up about antimicrobial. But you don't need to answer those.
Is that the way it'll be every week, Monday, if I'm not paying that?
That's right. This is the previous week, lecture in the lab. Okay, so here we go with antimicrobial. Let's talk about some general terms first. What's the difference between antibiotic and antimicrobial?
One is produced by a living organism.
Which one?
Antimicrobial.
Wrong.
Okay, antibiotic.
Okay, antimicrobial testing refers to the procedures that we often do. This is part of the microbiology laboratory. In addition to identifying the pathogen, there are many times when we identify what antibiotic or antimicrobial the pathogen is susceptible to. There are some rules for when we do this and when we don't do this, and I'm not going to go through all of those. Those are on your PowerPoint. But there are some terms that apply to this antimicrobial testing. Antibiotics are those substances that are produced naturally by microorganisms that kill other microorganisms. We call those antibiotics. Whereas an antimicrobial is a synthetic produced substance that kills microbes. Now, do we usually make a distinction when we go to the pharmacy and get a prescription filled for an antibiotic? Do we make a distinction between antibiotic and antimicrobial?
No.
Do we care?
No.
As long as it does the job.
The job.
We don't care. So, no, we don't usually. We usually just refer to everything as antibiotics. But that technically is the difference. Okay, what is the difference between bactericidal and bacteriostatic? Which one kills?
Cidal.
Okay, bactericidal is a substance that kills organisms. What does bacteriostatic do?
Inhibits
growth. Just inhibits the growth temporarily. Okay, then we have three terms that apply to treatment: specific treatment, empiric treatment, and prophylactic treatment. What is specific treatment?
For that particular bacteria.
Alex?
Yeah, like what she just said.
Okay. Yeah, specific treatment is treating a known organism. So we've already received the sample in the laboratory, we've already processed it and identified it, and so the doc then goes ahead and prescribes an antibiotic for that specific organism. So we've done the antimicrobial susceptibility testing on that. What's empiric treatment?
Not knowing the specific strain, but just treating against a broad spectrum.
Right. Treating the most likely pathogen. And there are certain situations where that's important. For example, if an infant comes into the emergency room and it's highly suspected that the infant has meningitis, the doc's not going to want to wait a day or two to get back the lab report to see what the pathogen is. So based on the age group of the patient, we'll talk about this later when we get into spinal fluids, the doc can prescribe treatment for the most likely pathogen. That's empiric treatment.
With empiric treatment, is it kind of like a shotgun approach where it really does kill tons of different types of organisms?
No, it's a little bit more narrow than a shotgun approach because they have a pretty good idea of what the pathogen is.
Okay.
And prophylactic treatment?
Preventive treatment.
Right. Okay. Commonly tested organisms. Because there are hundreds of organisms, we don't often do antimicrobial susceptibility testing on most of them. There are some that we usually do. One of these is Staph aureus. We're going to be talking about staphs and the streps next week. And Staph aureus, particularly because of MRSA. What is MRSA? Methicillin resistant Staph aureus. So there are some Staph aureus that is resistant to methicillin, which means it's usually resistant to most antibiotics. So if we have a MRSA strain, and that's kind of the scary buzzword right now is MRSA, because that's the Staph aureus strain that is not susceptible to most antibiotics. Vancomycin is usually the most powerful antibiotic that it is susceptible to. So there is also the Versa strain, VRSA, which is vancomycin-resistant Staph aureus. So you really don't want to get one of those strains of Staph aureus. Staph epidermidis we usually consider a normal flora because it's found most everywhere on the skin, and we usually just ignore it. However, if it is found in a blood culture, it could be a pathogen. It doesn't mean it is, but it could be. And we'll talk about that when we get into blood cultures. The Enterobacteriaceae are those organisms that are most likely found in the intestinal tract. We often do susceptibility testing on those. Pseudomonas is a non-fermenter. We did an example of that, but we did a Pseudomonas last week, the OF test. It's very difficult to treat. It's not a rampant pathogen, but when we do get Pseudomonas infections, it's very difficult to treat. And then other non-fermenters that might fall into that group, which we'll talk about later. Organisms not tested, and this list is not all-inclusive. It doesn't include everything, but we usually do not test, talking about antimicrobial susceptibility testing, group A strep, which is strep pyogenes. What does strep pyogenes cause?
Strep throat.
Strep throat. Okay. We usually don't do susceptibility testing on that because, as of now, up until now, it is not, most strains are not resistant to penicillin or other antibiotics. Penicillin is the drug of choice, unless you're allergic to penicillin, and then others may be given, but it's usually not shown resistance to many antibiotics, so we don't really have to test for it. Strep pneumoniae is the penicillin, again, is the drug of choice. We usually don't have to test for that unless it comes from blood or spinal fluid, which makes it a much more serious infection. Neisseria meningitidis causes meningitis. And again, it's usually still pretty much susceptible to penicillin. So these organisms that have known susceptibilities, we really don't have to do testing for. But again, this is not an all-inclusive list. Okay, let's talk about some procedures for doing antimicrobial susceptibility testing. One of these is the dilution method, the minimum inhibitory concentration, the MIC, minimum inhibitory concentration. Definition is the lowest concentration of a drug that prevents growth of a particular pathogen. So we've identified the pathogen, and now we want to know what concentration of drug will inhibit its growth. There's also another procedure we can do, which is the minimum bactericidal concentration. So minimum inhibitory concentration is the bacteriostatic method, whereas minimum bactericidal concentration is the method that kills, or the drug, the amount of drug that kills the pathogen. It's also known as, well, the MBC would be minimum bactericidal concentration. The MLC, sometimes it's referred to, is minimum lethal concentration. So it still refers to killing the organism, the lowest drug concentration that kills the pathogen. Sometimes docs want to know, usually they just want to know the MIC, but sometimes they want to know the MBC value as well. Okay, how do we do an MIC procedure? You don't really have to know exactly how we do this. You're not going to have to explain it or anything, but you do have to understand how to interpret it and basically how it's done. Okay, after we've identified the pathogen, we grow it up in a broth, and the broth is Mueller-Hinton broth. And we use Mueller-Hinton broth because it has the right concentrations of magnesium and calcium ions, which are necessary for these pathogens to grow. We grow it up in the broth until it is equal to a 0.5 McFarland standard in turbidity. Does anybody know what a 0.5 McFarland standard is? Okay, there's a picture here in your book, I believe. There's a series of tubes. It's made from sulfuric acid and barium chloride, I believe, that are in the laboratory. But they have just differing concentrations of turbidity. This is a 0.5 McFarland standard. If you put it in front of some script or something to read through it, you can see that there's a little bit of growth in here, but it's very slight. It's very weak growth, whereas this one's a 2 McFarland standard, and it's much thicker density. So what we want is a 0.5 McFarland standard. So there's two ways to do that. You can grow up your pathogen in the Mueller-Hinton broth. If it becomes, then you compare it to this standard. If it's too turbid, then we just add more Mueller-Hinton broth until we dilute it out to this level. Or we can just start from scratch, put a couple of the colonies in Mueller-Hinton broth and grow it up, keep watching it, until it reaches its concentration. So there's two ways to do it. But we want that standard, that level of standard, that turbidity. Okay, so then we take a series of tubes and we make serial dilutions of the antibiotic that we're going to be testing. So serial dilutions, two-fold dilutions, getting more and more dilute. Now we add 1 milliliter of our organism, the 0.5 McFarland standard organism, so that each tube has the same amount of organism. We incubate the tubes overnight, and then we look for visual turbidity. So we see turbidity in these tubes, which means that in this concentration of antibiotic did not inhibit the growth. So what's our definition of MIC? Lowest concentration of drug that inhibits the growth. So what is our MIC then? 8. So there's the lowest concentration of drug that inhibited the growth of the organism as determined by visual turbidity. So 8 MIC. Now, what we need to know is the organism susceptible? If we gave the patient an antibiotic that had a concentration of 8 micrograms per milliliter, is that enough to actually inhibit the growth of the organism? Well, there's another definition that we need to know, and that's breakpoint. The definition of breakpoint is the achievable level of antibiotic in the serum that will provide optimal therapy. In other words, can we put this much antibiotic, 8 micrograms per milliliter, into the patient, into the serum, without causing toxic symptoms? And if we can do that, then the patient, the organism is susceptible to the drug. So here's our kind of our rule of thumb, MIC. If it is less than or equal to the break point, then the organism is susceptible. But if the MIC is greater than the break point, which means we can't put enough drug into the patient without causing toxic symptoms, then we can't use that drug, or the organism is resistant to that drug.
So before, minimum lethal concentration, that has more to do with the patient than the organism, right?
No, we're not killing the patient.
No, but like MLC, that's the measurement of at what point it's toxic to the patient. Is that right?
MIC?
MLC.
MLC?
So
that's still the... what's our definition of MBC, MLC? The lowest concentration of drug that will kill the human.
Pathogen.
Okay, the pathogen.
So why would you
want to
inhibit the organism?
Because sometimes it's just enough to inhibit the organism for a period of time until your immune system can take over, start producing antibodies, and take care of it that way. If it's a really serious pathogen, then maybe we're more interested in the MDC level.
So these antibiotics are usually taken orally, right?
Most of them are orally. Some are injections, intramuscular.
How would you know that level of concentration would get to the actual tissue site if it was taken orally?
Well, that's the process of pharmacokinetics, and that's determined by the drug companies as they do all their studies and testing on these drugs before they ever release them. Now, all that stuff is determined. We actually spend a week next fall semester, talking about toxicology, and we go into pharmacokinetics and other processes. Okay, so that's how you do the MIC. Now, what if the doc wants to know the MBC, the minimum bactericidal concentration? What we can do then is take these three tubes that showed no growth, plate them out on a plate, incubate them overnight, and then look to see if there's any growth. So in the 8 micrograms per milliliter, the MIC, we did get growth. So this concentration then is inhibitory, but it is not bactericidal. So the MBC concentration is this one, which is 16 micrograms per milliliter. So again, sometimes docs want to know both. And we can do both if we use the tube test. Okay. Now, what we usually do, since the tube test is kind of cumbersome, how do we use all those tubes and dilutions? Usually what we do if we want to do the tube test is we use microtiter plates. And I'll show you a picture of that here in just a minute. But the most common procedure is to do a disc diffusion procedure. rather than a tube dilution. And this diffusion procedure is referred to as the Kirby-Bauer. Now, we're going to do this on Wednesday in lab. So listen up. Everybody wake? Ramesh? Okay. The Kirby-Bauer test involves filter paper disks that are impregnated with various antibiotics. So we can actually measure 12 or so antibiotics at the same time for one organism. And we use auger, an auger plate known as Mueller-Hinton auger. So instead of a broth, it's now an auger. Okay, this is the way we do Kirby-Bauer. So again, listen up because you're going to have to do this. You're going to do this in pairs. So one of you in your pair will do Staph aureus, which is a gram positive. The other one will do E. coli, which is a gram negative. And then you will look at both results and measure both results. Okay, first thing we do is we have to standardize the growth. So we take our pathogen again, and we grow it up to a concentration of the 0.5 McFarland standard. So it looks very, very weak. When we get our organisms on Wednesday to do this, the lab, the stock room, will have already done that for us, so you don't have to worry about it. It will come to us as a 0.5 McFarland standard. And just make sure, again, anytime these organisms have been sitting around in the tubes, make sure you flip the tubes, mix them well, because the organisms always settle at the bottom. So mix them well before you dip into them. Okay, the Mueller-Hinton plate is a large plate. Any of you seen Mueller-Hinton plates? Okay, they're about like this. They're not the small plates that we use, but they're large plates. Okay, we're going to take a Mueller-Hinton plate, and we're going to dip a swab into our broth, our organism, and then we're going to streak the plate in three directions. So we'll streak it in this direction, and then we turn it a quarter turn, and we streak it, or a third of a turn, and we streak it in the other direction, and then we turn another third of a turn and streak it in the other direction. The reason we do that is because we want to get confluent growth over the entire plate. We're not streaking for isolation. We don't want to leave any spaces. We want to get confluent growth over the whole plate. So we'll demonstrate this to you in the laboratory. Okay, then you apply the discs. And we actually have an applicator that sits over the plate. And it's got all of these filter paper discs in it. We just have to push down, and it delivers the filter paper discs. So it looks like that. Sometimes one of the discs gets stuck, and so we have to go in with forceps and remove the disc manually. And if we do that, anytime we use forceps, we have to first dip the forceps in ethyl alcohol, and then we have to go over to the Bunsen burner and flame them. So we sterilize the forceps anytime we use forceps. Okay, and then we touch the edge or the center of each disc with a pen or a pencil or with an applicator stick or something. Just touch it gently, and that's just to make sure it adheres to the auger. Okay, and then we incubate overnight, usually 24 hours, 37 air, okay, not CO2, 37 air. Incubate, remember you turn it upside down, so the lid is on the top, 37 air. And then the next day, we come in and we measure the zone size. So the smaller the zone size, we're going to measure the diameter. So we'll have some measuring devices in there. We'll measure the diameter of each one of these. In your packet, you have a couple pages that lists antibiotics and organisms. So you record the measurement, and then it tells you in there whether that zone size is resistant, susceptible, or intermediate. And so that's all you have to do is record the zone size and indicate whether it is resistant, susceptible, or intermediate. Okay, so those with small zone sizes are more likely to be resistant. So the organism is all of this growth here, and it's growing more closely to the disc, which means the antibiotic on this particular disc, as it diffuses out into the auger, is not as inhibitory to the organism because it can grow closer. Whereas those with large zone sizes are much more likely. The organism is more likely to be susceptible to the antibiotic.
Is there any interference from the antibiotic's ability to diffuse through the agar, or can they all diffuse the same?
We'll talk about that. There are some sources of error that you need to know. Okay, so that's Kirby Bauer. Any questions on Kirby Bauer? Okay, this is a microtiter plate, which shows a plate with just these little tiny wells in it. And sometimes lab will use this. In fact, they can purchase these. These each row here will have a different antibiotic in it. And each well has a different concentration. So these are just like serial dilutions of the antibiotics. And they can purchase these in a frozen state and just keep them in the freezer. And when they want to use them, they just pull them out, thaw them out, and then they add their suspension of the microorganism to each of these wells and look for the lowest concentration that caused, that inhibited the growth or that killed the organism. So these are very handy to use also because they're already prepared. But you can only use those antibiotics that are there. You can't change the antibiotics. Okay, so these are factors affecting zone size. So this is your question. And I'm not going to tell you the answers to all these. I want you to think about it. So what would happen to the growth of our organism or the diffusion of the antibiotic if we used an inoculum that was not 0.5? If it was too weak or if it was too heavy, what would happen to our zone size? The media composition. If we didn't use Mueller-Hittenauger, which had the magnesium and the calcium ions and the other things that are necessary, what would happen? Would our antibiotic diffuse the same? Would our organism grow the same? What would happen to temperature if we incubated it at 25 degrees instead of 27? Well, the organism's probably not going to grow. Antibiotic will diffuse, but the organism probably won't grow, so we're going to get larger zone sizes in that case. Or if we incubated at a higher temperature, the organism probably wouldn't grow either. It would inhibit the organism. The time, if we incubated it for 48 hours instead of 24 hours. If the disks are not properly stored, or if they're outdated, then perhaps the antibiotic is not going to diffuse as readily as it should because it's going to be maybe destroyed. The depth of the auger, when we pour these plates, the depth of the auger is 4 millimeters. So if we get auger that's 6 millimeters, then it's going to be more difficult for the antibiotic to diffuse through that auger that's thicker. The atmosphere, again, no CO2. The CO2 alters the pH and might change the growth patterns of the organism. And then, of course, if we make a mistake in our zone measurement. So we always have to think of operator error. Okay, so those are things that are, that affect the size. So think about the effect that, that those would have on Kirby Bauer. The advantages to Kirby Bauer, it's adaptable to large volume testing, so we can quickly do a lot of patient samples, and we can do a lot of antibiotics on one patient at the same time. It's easy to do and easy to interpret, and we use the multiple agents because we can use several antibiotics at a time. Okay, disadvantages, we have to standardize it. Of course, we have to standardize the MIC as well. With Kirby Bauer, we cannot determine MBC activity. So if the doc wants to know that, then we've got to use the tube dilution or we've got to use the microtiter plate to get the MBC level. And it can only be used with rapidly growing bacteria. Those will grow well in 24 hours. If there are some organisms that require, that are more fastidious, require a longer growth, we can't use Kirby Bauer. We've got to use some modification or something different for those organisms. Okay, occasionally we do a procedure called the serum bactericidal level, SBL, also known as the Schlichter test. So if anybody asks you what the Schlichter test is, you'll know. Can you say Schlichter? Okay, what this is, it's a measure of the activity of the patient's serum against the patient's pathogen. So this is after the patient has received an antibiotic. So we have identified the pathogen. The doc is giving them the antibiotic. They're taking the antibiotic. And now the doc wants to know, is this antibiotic the right antibiotic or the right concentration to inhibit the growth or kill the organism? So we draw the patient's blood. We take their serum, and we do serial dilutions of the serum and add the organism to that and see which concentration of antibiotic in the serum would inhibit or kill the organism. This is not done very frequently because now we have the capability of measuring individually certain drugs, certain antibiotics, in the laboratory. If the doc wants a cephalosporin level, we can just measure that in the laboratory, so which is much easier than doing a Schlichter test. But occasionally a Schlichter test will be requested. It's used occasionally as a broad guideline to determine if therapy is effective. So we're not going to do that, but just understand what the Schlichter test is. Okay, we need to talk about one of the rapid tests for antimicrobial susceptibility. Now, don't get mesmerized by this arrow here. Listen, okay? Don't look. I shouldn't have used that, probably. I can see Rumish, his eyes are turning already. Okay, this is the beta-lactamase test. Need to know. Need to know. NTK. Need to know. NTK. Need to know. Okay, this is a test for the production of beta-lactamase enzyme. So this is the enzyme that the organism produces. It can inactivate the beta-lactam ring found in penicillin and some cephalosporins. Okay, this is the structure of penicillin. This is the beta-lactam ring. Okay, that ring has to be intact in order for penicillin to destroy the cell wall, which is what it does of primarily gram-positive organisms. Organisms that are resistant to penicillin, one of the reasons they are resistant is because they produce this enzyme, beta-lactamase. And what that enzyme does is destroy the beta-lactam ring. So you can see it here, the beta-lactam ring is destroyed. So the organism produces the enzyme, destroys the penicillin before the penicillin has a chance to destroy the organism. So it's resistant to penicillin. So the beta-lactamase test is a quick test, usually can be done in 30 minutes or less, to determine if that organism is resistant to penicillin and the family of penicillin organisms. And some cephalosporins that also have this beta-lactam ring. Sometimes this test is called the beta-lactamase test. Sometimes it's called the cephinase test. Depends on who manufactures it. And sometimes it's called nitrocephin. So it's all pretty much the same thing. What happens is we're going to go from a yellow color to a red color in 30 minutes or less.
That's positive.
Okay, so right. So what we do, and it's just done on a filter paper disc that's got the cephinase is a chromogenic cephalosporin embedded into the paper disc. So we take the organism. In this case, it's Haemophilus influenza, and we just rub it on the disc. And if it produces the beta-lactamase, it will break up that beta-lactam ring in the cephinase, in the chromogen that's in there, and convert it from the white color to red, which is positive. So it turns red if the beta-lactam ring is destroyed. If it's not, if it's negative, it turns yellow. And so that can usually be determined again in 30 minutes or less. This one says within 10 minutes.
It's not the obvious, but when you do things like this, you're usually running the controls as well, just to see if maybe like the little disc test.
Oftentimes, you will run controls maybe on the batch of discs. Okay. You don't necessarily run controls every single time.
So the original color of the disc is yellow or it's white?
Yeah. It's white.
And so it turns yellow if it's negative and red if it's positive.
Right. So primarily, what we're looking for is just a red color. So that's the beta-lactamase, cephinase, nitrocephin. Okay, so everybody knows what beta-lactamase is? What it does? Everybody okay? Need to know? All right. Oops, I think we skipped something here. Okay, this is figure 12.1 in your book. I changed this because the new edition of the book, it's in a different chapter. Figure 12.1, it's on page 305, I believe, in your book. This just is a diagram that shows the main targets, five main targets of the most common antibiotics, how they destroy microorganisms. Some inhibit the cell walls. Some inhibit the cell membrane. Some interfere with essential metabolites, such as sulfur, that the drug, that the organism forms. Some interfere with either DNA or RNA synthesis. And some interfere with ribosome production and function. So those are the five main targets. You just kind of need to take a look at that and know what those targets are. So most all of the antibiotics that we use target one of these areas of the organism. Okay, three more terms. Synergism.
You work together to make a response.
Two or more drugs. So sometimes you take multiple drug therapy. So two or more drugs taken together where the action is greater than either drug alone. So that's good. Synergism is good. Antagonism is two or more drugs given together, but they antagonize each other. So the action is less than either one alone. That's not good. And then indifference is two or more drugs given together where it really doesn't matter. They're each going to do their own thing. They don't interfere with the other one. It really doesn't matter. Okay, let's move on then to diagnostic immunologic principles that we're going to talk about here. Okay, sometimes it's not prudent to isolate the organism, culture it. Sometimes we can't culture it, like viruses, for example. Can't culture viruses unless we send our sample to a virology lab. Because viruses are living organisms, intracellular organisms, they don't grow on agar, but they grow inside cells. So we have to send them to a virology lab that does cell cultures. And that gets very technical and tedious, time-consuming, and expensive. So an alternative to identifying viruses is to do immunologic procedures. Antibodies, identifying antibodies as an indication that the patient has been infected by that virus. We do that a lot for influenza, hepatitis. Okay, some organisms, these are bacterial organisms, are fastidious organisms, which means they their growth requirements are too extensive for us to grow in the laboratory, or they might be too pathogenic for us to want to mess around with in the laboratory. So again, the alternative is to determine antibodies to these organisms. Critical illness, if the patient, again, mentioning meningitis, infant comes in with meningitis, we do have an antibody test against certain organisms that cause meningitis that can be done very quickly. And again, the doctor needs that diagnosis quickly. And certain toxins. You can use the toxin as the antigen and do an antigen antibody study against toxins, and we're going to talk about those later when we get into those. So those are some of the applications then for doing immunology, antigen antibody studies, instead of culturing the organism. Okay, a couple more terms we need to identify. Sensitivity and specificity. There's two different ways to define these. There's the analytical sensitivity, which is the ability of a test to detect a particular analyte. Specificity, the ability of a test to react only with the analyte of interest. So sensitivity is actually detecting the smallest amount. If you had strep throat and you had just a tiny, tiny bit of strep pyogenes in your throat, we would still want that to be positive. Specificity is if you didn't have strep throat, we would not want the test to be positive, to tell you that you did have strep. So we want the test to react only with the analyte.
What is an analyte?
The pathogen in this case. Okay, now the other definition is clinical or diagnostic sensitivity specificity. Okay, so clinical sensitivity is the frequency of a positive test result in patients with the disease. These are the true positives. Let's say you all had strep throat. If we did a test on all of you, we would want every one of you to be positive, right? True positives. Okay, specificity, frequency of negative test results in patients without the disease. So these are the true negatives. Let's say none of you had strep throat. You're all healthy. And we did a test on all of you. We would want them all to be negative. But occasionally, we get false positives and we get false negatives. Okay.
Why would you want to do those tests? Those last ones. Like, why would we want everyone to be positive or negative?
Well, if you have strep throat, you go to the doc, and the doc does a throat swab on you, and you do have strep throat, you want that culture to be positive. Okay? So you want a test. We want them to use a test that has high sensitivity. If you don't have strep throat, you want them to use a test that has high specificity so that it won't react with anything else and give you a false positive. Okay, so let's determine that sensitivity. Again, this is the percent positives among all diseased. So this is the true positives. So the way we figure out sensitivity is true positives divided by the false negatives, because occasionally we're going to get some that are false negative, plus the true positives. Let's say we had 1,000 people. 950 of these people had strep throat. Well, let's say they all had strep throat, but 950 of them came up positive. These are the true positives. 50 of them, however, came up negative, so these would be false negatives, because they really did have strep throat, but the test showed that it was negative. So that gives us a sensitivity of 95% for that test. Culture, rapid strep test, whatever test we're doing. Actually, 95% is pretty good. We'll probably never reach 100% sensitivity or specificity. But the higher, the better, because that means the fewer false negatives in terms of sensitivity.
Is PCR-based stuff a lot more sensitive?
Yeah, we're going to talk just a little bit about PCR. Okay, so sensitivity is good for screening a lot of people. Specificity, then, is the percent negatives among all non-diseased, among healthy. So if you're healthy, you want to be negative if we're testing for strep throat. So again, let's say we had 1,000 people. The true negatives, they're all healthy, so true negatives divided by false positives. So occasionally you're going to get some tests that turn out positive when they really don't have strep throat. Those are false positives. So let's say we had 855 true negatives. The test came out negative, but 145 of those healthy people showed a positive result. That's a false positive. So that gives us 85% specificity, which is not so good, because that means 15% of the time people are going to be diagnosed with strep throat when they really don't have it, or whatever else we're testing for. So that's how we use those terms, sensitivity and specificity, and what these numbers mean. So just need to know sensitivity, specificity, and those very simple formulas. Okay. Specificity is most important for diagnosis, because you really don't want to diagnose a person with a disease if they don't have it. Okay, antibody titers. A titer is the concentration of the antibody. Sometimes we want to know what the concentration of the antibody is. And we can do a single titer, or we can do rising titers. Single titer means we just draw the blood once. Patient has some symptoms, they've got a disease, we just draw the blood once, anytime during the course of a disease, and we measure the antibody. Now, sometimes if they have an IgG antibody, that can stay elevated for a long period of time after the disease has disappeared. There are some tests where we can actually divide the antibodies into IgM and IgG, which is the first antibody that's produced.
IgM.
So if we did an IgM test and it was positive, then it's most likely the symptoms that you have are due to that particular disease, because IgM is the first one produced. So a single titer is very adequate for something like HIV, hepatitis, which you're not likely to have antibodies unless you have the disease or have had it in the past. Okay, rising titers, we sometimes refer to these as paired titers, or we also refer to these as acute and convalescent sera. And we will come back to this later. So later when I ask you, okay, what is acute and convalescent sera, you'll all be able to raise your hand. Need to know. Okay, what we do, and we don't often do this in the laboratory, because what you have to do in order to do acute and convalescent is you have to get the patient to come in while they're in the acute stage of the disease, which means the early phase of the disease. This is most useful for chronic diseases that are going to last a longer period of time. So if the patient does come in during the acute phase, we draw their blood, and we're usually going to hold it until maybe a couple weeks later. The patient comes back, we draw the blood again. That would be the convalescent. Hopefully they're in the convalescent stage then. And then we run both of these together, and that just minimizes differences in running the test if we do them both together. But it doesn't always have to be done that way. We're going to make serial dilutions of patient's serum. And what we have to see in order to diagnose that patient with that chronic disease is we have to see if they're acute serum, for example, and acute, the antibody phase should be lower because they're just in the beginning stages of the disease. They haven't produced a lot of antibody. So let's say their antibody was 1 to 4. A convalescent stage that's gone on a bit longer, now their antibody titer should be higher if they actually have the disease, right? Okay, so now it's 1 to 16. What we need to see in order to diagnose a positive acute and convalescent serum is at least a 2-fold dilution, or I should say a 4-fold dilution, because there's 4 times the amount. So a 4-fold dilution, which would be 2 doubling dilutions. So a 4-fold dilution. We need to see at least that difference between acute and convalescent. If the convalescent was 1 to 8, it could be that maybe that's just within the limitations of the test. So it doesn't necessarily indicate that the antibody titer is rising over that period of time. Okay, so does everybody understand the acute convalescent?
So this isn't used for, like, diagnosing a short-term disease?
No. This is more for chronic, right. Because we've got to have that period of time in between there. But the other difficulty is we don't often see the patient in the acute phase. So we don't often get that sample.
So then, to restate, so you're saying that's how you can tell when a patient has entered the convalescent stage of the disease, when there's been a flare?
No, that's when you can actually diagnose that they have that disease.
What's maybe an example of a disease that would be tested that way?
Any chronic disease, tuberculosis, for example, is a chronic disease, a long-term disease. Some weird ones like tularemia, brucellosis, that we'll talk about later, which are more chronic type diseases. Typhoid fever, those are examples. And those are also diseases which we don't see very much anymore. So that's why we don't do this a lot, but in some cases, it's very helpful to be able to do that. Okay, methods of antigen antibody. One is precipitation. Well, there's precipitation, there's agglutination. Precipitation involves a soluble antigen, like maybe a polysaccharide on the surface of the bacteria. Now, I'm not going to go through all of these tests here. We don't have time. You can kind of take a look at those. The other one is agglutination, which uses a particulate antigen. So this would be a larger antigen, like the actual bacteria itself. A red blood cell, perhaps. We use agglutination in blood bank, immunohematology, which you're going to learn a lot about. So agglutination can be either bacterial, so we use the bacteria. There are several diseases known as febrile agglutinins. We'll talk about that later. Anybody know what FUO means? Designation FUO? Any guesses? Fever of unknown origin. Now, often you get that on a diagnosis. The doc doesn't know what's wrong. The patient comes in, they've got a fever. So it's probably bacterial, maybe viral. But that's the only thing that the doc can put down is fever of unknown origin. So these febrile agglutinins actually refer to several different types of organisms that might produce that. And we'll talk about those later. Or we can use particle agglutination. I'm not going to talk about these last two. I'll talk about latex because that's the most common one, and you've probably all done latex agglutination. Okay, these are little latex beads. And attached to the bead is a specific antibody. Again, if we're measuring strep, this would be an antibody to strep that would be attached to the latex bead. Then we add the antigen, the organism from the patient. The organism will bind to the specific antibody in such a way that it pulls all of these latex beads together so that we see visible agglutination. These are usually done on a slide test. We did these in 102, any of you that took 102. If you remember doing the slide tests and shaking around looking for visible agglutination. So these are large enough antigens that we can visually see them, whereas with precipitation we can't visually see them. So, and these are very quick tests. But sometimes specificity is a problem, as well as sensitivity with these latex tests. Okay, we need to talk about ELISA, because that's used quite a bit, as well as the fluorescent tests. I've only got a couple minutes left, so I'm going to really fly through these. But you can go back to your chapters and read about them. ELISA, we usually use either a tube or a microtiter plate. And it's got an antigen adsorbed to the surface. So we purchase these, a known antigen, for a certain test, like HIV. And then we add the patient's serum containing the antibody, if in fact they do have the antibody. The antibody binds to the antigen. We then add a second antibody. It's an antibody that binds to the patient's antibody, but it's labeled with an enzyme. Enzymes convert substrate to product. So we then add a suitable substrate that will allow the enzyme to convert the substrate to product. We stick this in a spectrophotometer and we can measure the color change or the density. And this is what they use for HIV screening tests, hepatitis screening tests, is the ELISA method. Okay, sometimes they use fluorescence. There's a direct fluorescence and there's an indirect fluorescence. Direct fluorescence tests for an unknown antigen. A good example here is testing for trepanemapalidin, which is the cause of aging syphilis. So they might use this setup in an STD clinic, a sexually transmitted disease clinic. They take some of the pussy material from the syphilis patient, spread it on a slide, add a known labeled antibody. This would be an antibody to trepanemapalidin that's labeled with a fluorescent label. This binds, makes a complex, and then we can observe for fluorescence under the microscope. We'll take a look at that here in a minute. Indirect fluorescence is measuring for unknown antibody. So we purchase slides that have antigen on them, like mouse, liver, rat, kidney tissue or something that's got antigen. We then add the patient's pussy material, serum, whatever that has the antibody. Forms a complex which is invisible at this point until we add a labeled antibody. This is an antibody against the patient's antibody, makes it labeled fluorescent. We then look at these under the fluorescent microscope. And here you can see the trepanemes very easily. Pretty neat. So these are not usually done in a routine microlaboratory, but they are done in clinics, like I said, where they would see a lot of samples of trepanemes. Last thing I want to mention is nucleic acid probes. Okay, this is the newest thing that's coming into the laboratory, these probes. Actually, we're out of time, aren't we? I've got two slides here. I will finish these up on Wednesday. Probes and rapid antibodies.